Welcome to the By Degrees Climate Summit, a collaboration between New Hampshire Public Radio and New Hampshire PBS. NHPR's By Degrees reporting project was created in order to tell stories of local people grappling with the challenges of our changing world and exploring possible solutions. Over the course of the summit, we heard from pioneering journalists, environmental activists, and industry leaders. They shared their insights, strategies, and success stories, demonstrating that through collaboration and know-how, we can make a significant difference for our New England communities. Strong storms and flooding in 2023 brought millions of dollars worth of damages and personal losses to people across New England. As towns and cities rebuild, it's imperative that our regional communities undertake these efforts together. Today's conversation is centered on how local communities are planning for the future and was recorded before a live audience on May 23, 2024 at the University of New Hampshire, Durham. Justine Paradise, producer for NHPR's Outside In podcast, is our host. And today she's speaking with Kari White, director of Community Health Equity, Northern Counties Healthcare, Claudia Diaz-Martinez, Policy Fellow for the City of Boston's Environmental Department, and Brianna O'Brien, Conservation Coordinator for the Town of Hampton, New Hampshire.
Welcome, everyone, to the 2024 By Degrees Climate Summit. I'm Justine Paradise. I'm a reporter and producer with NHPR's Outside In podcast. We are already experiencing climate change. Just in the past year, New England experienced many storms and flood damage from the coast of Maine to the river valleys of Vermont in July, December, January, and in April. These events can, of course, be very painful, but in our response, we can catch glimpses of the future. Writer and climate activist Rebecca Solnit writes, "Disaster offers a view into another world for ourselves." And I really believe that. For example, after Katrina, residents of the Ninth Ward in New Orleans created a structure of mutual aid with their neighbors, sharing food, first aid, and meeting people's needs. And this is the kind of thing we see all the time. We've seen it here in New England. Some of the people on this panel can speak directly to that. And so even though climate change is a catastrophe, it is an opportunity to build systems that work better for all of us. But how? How do we do that? And how do we do it in a sustained and long-term way around climate solutions that could take years? And how do we do that with our neighbors and local governments? So let's start with the topic of this panel. Why are we talking about the local today? A lot of people experience limitations and hurdles that come from getting government assistance in the wake of disasters, meaning that community-generated solutions are essential. But why is that? I'd like to hear from each of you, what is something that's happened in your region that couldn't have been done or would have been so much harder without community involvement? Maybe something that even could only have been done coming from the local. Brianna, can we start with you?
Sure, yeah. I think that when we're thinking about the action that we're taking at a local level, we want to be prepared and mitigating disasters, and the preparedness, we want to have that ahead of the disasters happening. And in Hampton, we have a lot of really amazingly involved residents who have advocated for years for the health of their community, specifically the folks along the coast and who border the marsh. A lot of the priorities that Hampton has really focused on over the past few years wouldn't have happened without their advocacy. In 2014, because of their work and their consistency in showing up to town meetings, and their questioning and their concerns being brought to light repeatedly, the town did some studies, and that led to further studies and eventually became a pretty, at this point, robust priority for the town of Hampton to focus on climate resilience and coastal resilience across most of our departments.
Kari, what about you?
So I would say that in the Northeast Kingdom, which happens to be 2,000 square miles, right? It's a huge region. It's very rural. Has a history of timber industries and sort of those shutting down, leading to intergenerational poverty, right? Transportation issues, chronic health issues. The opioid crisis has not spared the Northeast Kingdom, high levels of suicide, right? People are feeling desperate. And when a disaster strikes, it just shines a light on the existing disparities and issues that people are dealing with in their day-to-day life. So when there are governmental agencies that come in the wake of a disaster, rightfully so, many of our disenfranchised neighbors are very wary of going into a space, sitting across a table with a person representing the government in a uniform who knows nothing about them, their situation, their family. So regardless of how beneficial those resources might be, the messenger matters. And so I think in the Northeast Kingdom, where we have a really strong neighbor-to-neighbor mutual aid network, we have some incredible community organizing groups, Northeast Kingdom Organizing, for example, we're able to be relationship brokers and work with our friends and neighbors and people sort of on the margins of our community who are mistrustful of these services and these resources to say, you know, I will come with you. I will sit with you. We will figure out this paperwork. Yep, let me come to your house with you. We can find the deed to your house because they need that, right? So it's simple things like that. But if you don't have those relationships ahead of time, you've got little chance of sparking those up when you need to, when a disaster strikes. So that work and that relationship building needs to happen, and it needs to be an ongoing thing.
That's a really good point. Claudia, what about you?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thank you for being here. Back in Boston, I've been very honored and privileged to be part of what I see as one of the most significant programs that we have in the city to achieve carbon neutrality. And the name of that program is BERDO, which stands for the Building Emissions Reduction and Disclosure Ordinance. And I won't go into much detail right now. But one of the reasons I feel so much pride to be part of the team that is implementing this program now is that it is one of the few building decarbonization programs of its kind in the United States that has such intentional components for environmental justice, and that not only has explicit goals for justice, but also has very intentional measures to make sure that the implementation of the program is equitable and that our most vulnerable communities in Boston can ultimately benefit from better buildings. And I can say that this program would not exist, or it would not exist in this way, if it wasn't for the commitment of a lot of community-based organizations in Boston that put a lot of work throughout the years to have this program in place to have better buildings in the city.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk more about justice a little bit later, but right now, Boston has committed to becoming carbon neutral by 2050, which reflects the Paris Agreement and federal goals. You mentioned buildings, but what does carbon neutrality for a city mean? Can you break that down a little?
Sure. So in this context, carbon neutrality would mean that we are reducing the emissions that we produce as a city as much as we can. And those emissions that still remain after all of our mitigation efforts can be mitigated in other ways. So like through renewable energy in other parts, or by having other types of efforts that benefit the community. So that's the goal that we have as a city to reach by 2050. And BERDO, this program, is one of the key pieces for that.
Thank you. So, Kari, you and others in the Northeast Kingdom created this long-term recovery group, and you've been part of that has been trying to find contractors to provide estimates for repair work. And you called this the steepest learning curve of your life. That's a direct quote. What do you mean by the steepest learning curve of your life? How so?
So I pride myself on sort of preparation. I don't love surprises. And when there's a challenge or task in front of me, I go all in and I do hours of research. I talk to as many people as I can possibly find who I think might be able to shed some light on whatever challenge or situation it is. And still, despite months being part of this work in this long-term disaster recovery work, I am reminded on a daily basis how little I know and how little I understand and how it shifts every single day and how complex this is. It doesn't matter how much reading you do. It doesn't matter how many different organizations and entities, federal, state, local, that you talk to. it seems like there is very little clarity to be had. So I just know that it feels like I'm climbing up this steep mountain. And I just don't know if there's a summit. I feel like it might be just this mountain that you'd never reach the top of. I don't know.
Well, how did it start?
So the Northeast Kingdom has the benefit of having really long-standing, and I'm talking decades-long, partnerships, cross-sector, cross-organizational partnerships to work really in deep collaboration with one another. So we have a history of strong and trusting organizational and individual relationships, which without those, when this disaster hit and there was this push to establish this thing called a long-term recovery group, which is sort of the FEMA recognized way to do disaster recovery, we were able to structure ourselves in that very specific way to be recognized and to be able to become an entity that could benefit from philanthropic and potentially government assistance and dollars and programs, et cetera. So, you know, it's been a really interesting thing. And thank goodness I have people in my life and in my community that I can pick up the phone and call and say, hey, there's this really hairy issue. I don't know if it's a bread box or a barn. I have no idea what it's going to mean. I really don't know what role you're going to play, what I'm asking you to do, how much time it's going to take, or how long it's going to end, or when it's going to end, if it's going to end, or if we can even recognize and achieve any level of success. Sound good? Are you in? Right? And I have enough people in my life that'll say, ugh. Okay, sure, I'm in. Like, let's figure this out together and like understand it's gonna feel terrible sometimes, but I'm not alone. I'm not an individual in this trying to figure this out. I have a team of people. Yeah.
A bread box or a barn is a beautifully New England metaphor, just to say. We heard from a listener named Nate who wrote us, when an applicant for a building permit develops engineering plans to account for flooding, they often only need to account for 25-year storm events. We know that 1,000-year storm events now happen every few years. Almost all buildings and development in New Hampshire have been poorly designed to manage stormwater for flooding that occurs increasingly frequently. I'm wondering, you mentioned buildings, Claudia, as part of your work. Can you speak to this in Boston as well?
Well, I'm not part of like the construction of buildings. BERDO is a building decarbonization program for existing buildings. So the challenge here is to decarbonize the buildings that are already up there. But it can provide opportunities to think about resilience. But I think maybe Brianna has more
insight. I see you nodding, Brianna.
it's a really challenging system to navigate, knowing kind of the shortcomings of FEMA's mapping systems and what they account for, and oftentimes when they're released, they're already antiquated because of how dynamic floodplains are, and with the changing climate, there's a lot of nuance to that isn't often captured in those maps, and therefore is not required by building code and by FEMA's standards. In Hampton, we have adopted higher standards for our building requirements, and they allow for more freeboard depending on the type of structure. So freeboard being how much higher above the base flood elevation a building has to be built to, certain stormwater management requirements. So it was actually a really great kind of dynamic community. There was community involvement. There was a lot of stakeholders involved in these conversations as we discussed what that ordinance update would look like. And we were able to evaluate different options and what made the most sense for what, you know, kind of where we were at as a community. And so that was adopted, I think it was this spring. And so we're looking at much more resilient structures moving forward, if new structures or substantially improved structures.
Thanks for listening to the By Degrees Climate Summit, a collaboration between New Hampshire Public Radio and New Hampshire PBS. Coming up, our panel will talk about budgets and equity. We'll be back shortly to hear more of this discussion. Welcome back to the By Degrees Climate Summit, a collaboration between NHPR and New Hampshire PBS. This conversation is centered on how local communities are planning for the future and was recorded before a live audience on May 23, 2024 at the University of New Hampshire Durham campus. Our host is NHPR's Justine Paradise, and she's speaking with Kari White, Director of Community Health Equity, Northern Counties Healthcare, Claudia Diaz-Martinez, Policy Fellow for the City of Boston's Environmental Department, and Brianna O'Brien, Conservation Coordinator for the Town of Hampton, New Hampshire.
I'd like to turn now to a super sexy subject that I think that we'll all know what I'm about to say, which is municipal budgets and their role in setting climate priorities in our backyards. It actually is fascinating, Claudia. You wrote a paper about this published in the journal Nature, and you argue that municipal finance should be thought of as a, quote, set of ethical and political choices that can be used to move forward on climate action and justice. What do you mean by that?
That's a great question. And well, myself, I never thought I would be excited about anything related to finance ever. So it was a surprise to then spend a lot of years of my PhD focused on that. But I like when you think about it, municipal finance is in the end a reflection of what we value as a society. So we're saying this is what it's worth investing our money in. This is what we value. This is what we think is the best for us in the future. And cities, towns can have a lot of climate goals and all of these targets and beautiful commitments. But in the end, if the money is not put into climate action, it is likely that nothing would happen or not that much will happen. So that paper, I really want people to, you know, become more curious about things that sound so boring, like municipal budgets or, you know, revolving funds and where their city is putting money. And we found that actually, in terms of climate change, the decisions that municipalities make for their budgets or financial decisions can really impact what city officials are ultimately able to do. We found that first, it can impact the types of climate programs that can get implemented in cities. So cities, for example, would be more likely to prefer to implement programs that are profitable and that have some savings involved. And a lot of the times, things like resilience or adaptation are seen like where there's no money in that. Maybe there's savings in the future, maybe we'll have a little less damage if there's another storm, but that's less exciting for the financial people than, oh, we're gonna replace this heater with new electric heat pump and we'll have these savings in 2 years. So that's one. And then also how you get money can impact when and for how long you're actually able to implement a program, from budgeting cycles to grants that say you have to spend all your money by X day, or you can only spend it on this geography and you cannot spend money that could possibly be in another community that it's your neighbor. And then it shifts power to decide what is worth investing in our community. So instead of municipal budgets, instead of looking at their community and seeing what are you prioritizing, what do you need, they also need to be thinking about, well, what do credit agencies prefer? What will investors want to see in our municipal bonds? So in that way, it shifts a bit of power to decide, well, what is worth investing in, when, how, and for whom?
Fascinating. Thinking about multiple budget cycles and how you know, climate action has to be sustained over many, many years and often many budget cycles, I'm curious if either of you, Brianna or Kari, have experience with managing, you know, we need to continue this beyond this budget cycle, or when it was a struggle or when it was a success.
Well, I will say that we are incredibly fortunate to have the Vermont Community Foundation in the state of Vermont, who has stepped up in a big way as a funder and a very transparent funder, who is willing to have conversations and hear what is working, what is not working, and where they can be helpful in a very reasonable way in terms of grant requirements for applications or reporting. It might just be a conversation, like, how did you spend the money? Did it help in what you were hoping to do? So they have been incredibly just a real partner, which has been a breath of fresh air and very helpful. But there's no money in this for us as a long-term recovery group, right? We're basically a vehicle that is trying to disperse funding on behalf of individual survivors in our communities that have been impacted. And the real money in disaster recovery goes to these huge national organizations like the Red Cross or the Methodist Church, et cetera, who have years of coming into disaster impacted communities and getting these hundreds, millions of dollar grants to like staff up capacity wise, right? And do these rebuilding projects as part of their ministry work and whatnot. And that's a wonderful resource to have, but it's not embedded in our community. It's this external resource that comes in, saves the day, and then leaves. So sustainability of these efforts, it's called long-term recovery for a reason, right? This is like a five-year process, and the chance, at least, I mean, that's actually, it's probably gonna be more than that for our communities. And that's a bitter pill to swallow because people are suffering right now, and they've been suffering since July. So you never feel like you're moving fast enough. But where do we go for the next event that is sure to happen between now and when our survivors from the July flooding recover, right? So it's constantly being on the lookout for grant opportunities and partnerships who might have some resources to bring to the table to help our capacity. But it's a never-ending process. I wish there was a different way. I don't know what it is.
Brianna?
Yeah, I think I have a little bit of a different lens to add to that, which is kind of piecemealing together small grant opportunities and trying to use that as holistically as possible and plan for that as holistically and comprehensively as possible with the short term and the long term in mind. Some of these small grant opportunities are for, you know, a project that happens within a year, and then where do you go from? Like then what happens? And then there's the capacity issues with who's going to be managing that project. Is it a capacity issue that you solve with short-term grant funding, and then you're in the same cycle again with a short-term position that's managing a short-term project, and then how do you get longevity out of that? So, one of the things that I think is helpful to kind of think, to reframe that, is understanding that climate resilience is not going to happen just in its own climate resilience department. So bringing climate resilience into all of the different types of work that's happening within a municipality and embedding it into everybody's work. So yes, ideally the town of Hampton will have a coastal resilience, climate resilience department, but also there will be sustainability and longevity by everybody embedding that into their work day to day and holistically looking at grant opportunities and projects together and being able to, instead of the piecemeal short-term approach, taking the time to think about how to use the funding and the opportunity as a whole town. And that does take time up front. It does take away, maybe you miss a couple of grant cycles while you're planning out what the next couple of years look like and while you're reframing certain departments' work. There, again, a bitter pill to swallow. There are many in this work, but that funding may be not advantageous to go after while you're planning how to make future funding more sustainable.
Actually, I want to turn to equity here. Climate change, of course, affects people in the same community quite differently, and members of a community may disagree on which issues to prioritize. Claudia, can you give us a clear example of what climate inequity might look like and an example of a justice-minded solution?
Sure. I think we don't have to go very far to notice climate injustice or climate inequity within our towns and cities. So thinking specifically about climate change, for example, a heat event, or when we have just a very, very hot day, we all experience it very differently depending on our circumstances. So it's not going to be the same to experience a heat wave if you work an office job and you're on the AC all day versus you have a work outdoors, or if you're even on a house. So just that single day in one single event, our experiences are going to be tremendously differently. Or even where our houses are located, do we have access to green space? Do we have access to air conditioning? And all of these issues of access come from, you know, structural injustices in our communities, from environmental racism, colonialisms, and so on. So we are not all starting from the same place. So climate change is not an equalizer where, oh, well, we all suffer from climate change. We will all experience rising temperatures or storms or disasters, but we're not all in the same place to recover at the same rate or to be protected from those things.
So thinking about a solution that would have justice in mind, what would be an example?
I think for a very simple example, I think the most environmental thing that people have always in mind, and people make fun of me, is like, oh, you're just planting trees. But even something as simple as that, it's like, it's not just about planting trees, but where? Where is there no access to green space right now? Thinking about who would benefit from this, and then not just going and planting trees and be like, yay, now you have trees in a park, but like, what would you like in that park? What are the services that your community is lacking? So even just switching the mindset from just like, we're coming here and we know we need more trees and we're just planting them. Well, where, how, why, and what other services do you need? Going to the community first.
You're nodding. Kari, do you have anything to add?
Well, I'm so happy you mentioned, Claudia. This country was founded on a relationship to the land that is extractive, right? That is about individual gain and about exploiting and power over, right? That is still alive. That is still dictating who gets to say what happens, how, and when. That gets intertwined in our conversations. Entirely dictates where money goes, because it's the values of it's like manifest destiny, right? It's like this is mine for the taking, and there are some people who are not worthy of those resources. They are not valued the same, and so they don't have the same access. And I think of access as being multifaceted, right? I think of the term access in all its forms, because you could have physical access, financial access, social access to something, but if you know that you don't belong, that you're not wanted, that the rules and regulations have been designed to exclude you and people like you, you are not likely to access that resource. So is that actual access? I don't think so. So it does come down to questioning sort of the systems, the water we're swimming in, right? And being very intentional about questioning that. And your sort of role and your privilege in perpetuating the status quo too, right? You can't just be an observer to the systems. You are part and parcel. So this idea that you can just sort of tinker from the outside and fix things, I think is erroneous. And so it's really this constant questioning of, am I representing privilege? Am I wielding my privilege to help myself? Or am I being in service of others who don't look like me, who are not white, who are not employed, who do not have a financial and stable situation, right? So it's that constant questioning of, am I perpetuating the status quo, or am I doing something to recognize it and make it visible so we can do something about it together?
As far as doing something about it together, when it comes to the coast, of course, erosion and sea level rise are a huge issue. I myself grew up on Nantucket Island off of Cape Cod, which obviously has a lot of vacation homes, a lot of wealth, but also sea level rise is a risk to critical infrastructure and to the working class community as well. It's always this dance where there are tensions around which areas that we as a community are going to prioritize to try to protect, and the dynamics of wealth and power and inequity are at play. Brianna in Hampton, also on the coast, how do you as a community decide which projects to prioritize? Where does that conversation happen?
It's a really, really challenging question that we deal with all of the time. And I was thinking as Kari and Claudia were talking that when we do prioritize solutions, we do try to solicit input from community members, from partnering organizations, and we want to make sure that the solutions we're pursuing are mindful of all those that are affected. But sometimes the people that can make it to the table are the people that are retired, that aren't at work that day, that don't have to, bring their children, to a doctor's appointment. So being mindful of who is at the table and trying to find alternative ways to bring them into the conversation to consider what solutions might be more effective for them than we might realize and unintentionally cause harm through the solutions that we do prioritize, and find new avenues to solicit feedback and questions and concerns. It really is an ever-evolving practice for our town.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back with more from our panel discussion, how local communities are planning for the future. Coming up, a discussion on how people can get involved at the local level. The ByDegrees Climate Summit is a collaboration between New Hampshire PBS and New Hampshire Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Today's panel from the ByDegrees Climate Summit, How Local Communities Are Planning for the Future, was recorded in front of a live audience at the University of New Hampshire Durham on Thursday, May 23rd, 2024. Our host is NHPR's Justine Paradise, and she's speaking with Kari White, Director of Community Health Equity, Northern Counties Healthcare, Claudia Diaz-Martinez, Policy Fellow for the City of Boston's Environmental Department, and Brianna O'Brien, Conservation Coordinator for the Town of Hampton, New Hampshire.
Let's talk about how to get people involved and how to rally people to stay involved. So if you're a citizen and you're starting from outside of politics, you want to see more climate action in your city, how do you start? What are specific offices or committees or people that you can look for?
Sure. Well, I think if you live in a town or city that is big enough and have enough resources to have its own climate department or environment department, that's a good place to start, but that's not the reality in a lot of our municipalities. But I would encourage people to actually look at their budgets and figure out who makes those decisions and how can you influence those decisions in the future. There's no standards for municipal budgets, so almost every town it's different, and the documents will look differently and decisions are made differently, so I would encourage you to figure out how that works where you live.
Get into those budgets, yeah. Brianna, as a conservation coordinator, how do residents help you do your job? When people approach you, what do you like to see and what do you wish you saw more of?
I couldn't do my job without residents who reach out to me with questions, with ideas for solutions, with concerns, with volunteer requests. My work is so driven by resident input. I love when people come and ask questions about what they can or should not do on their property, because I think stewarding your own property responsibly is such an important first step in breaking down the barrier between you and the world around you, the natural world around you, and finding ways to do that well. Even just not mowing your grass as short is like it, just making those simple decisions to really connect with your natural world through your own backyard, or through the park in your neighborhood, or through whatever green space you have access to, is really a super important first step. And then I think residents who are monitoring their communities and their natural spaces and reporting back to me on what they're seeing is I can't put a weight on how important that is. There are lifelong residents who have been monitoring the size of the dunes by their homes for 30 years and have photo evidence of how these dunes have changed and evolved. And, you know, it's not official data collection, but it ultimately becomes that in how we're using it. The residents who are really paying attention and trying to learn how to better pay attention to their natural world and again, break down that barrier between them as a human and the outside world, and coming to me or many of the different offices in our town office with those questions and concerns and any public town meeting, you know, those are great avenues for that kind of work and that kind of dialogue.
Yeah, a real treasure trove, that kind of knowledge gathering. Kari, if someone's hearing about your work, a long-term recovery group, and thinking, oh, we need that in my region, what advice do you have for someone who's thinking about starting one?
Be as clear-eyed as you can that it is complicated. It is long-term. You need friends and allies. And you need to stay true to what's calling you to do that and sort of the authentic part of you that wants to be in service of your community. And that can help you, I think, come back and recenter yourself amidst the sort of swirl of bureaucracy and rules and regulations and the literal mountains of paper that you will encounter. It's like, what is the why and how does that align with my greater purpose and my call to service? So it's going to be hard. I think just being very realistic that it's going to be hard. Talk to everybody that you can who has been through it, who has established a long-term recovery group in a community like yours, as much as possible, sort of the same size, maybe the same sort of cultural feel. And then give yourself the grace to know that you are going to make a lot of mistakes. And that is part of it. Right? So do it because it matters. Be realistic about the change, the sort of change you want to see and how long that's actually going to take.
We got a listener question about mitigation and adaptation, which we've been touching on here and there. Mitigation being reducing our impact, transitioning off fossil fuels, and adaptation, finding ways to live with the impacts like extreme heat. So Susan in Durham says, have we abandoned efforts to reverse climate change? Is adaptation our only focus now? Claudia, what do you think?
Well, all of my life is about mitigations these days. So we're still working on climate mitigation, and that's still critical. I think they are both one of like sides of the same coin. One cannot exist without the other. And in many ways, they can both support each other, and we need to see them. Well, resilience, mitigation, and justice all as one and not as these separate things with separate people and separate departments. I can give more insight into what we're doing in Boston if that's
yeah, helpful. Are there things that have you focused on that are able to address both?
Sure. So this building decarbonization program that I've been talking about essentially mandates existing large buildings in Boston to become net zero by 2050, and they have to reduce their emissions progressively over time. And they have multiple ways to do that, and one of those involves making improvements to existing buildings. So that could mean improving insulation and doing energy efficiency work, weatherization, changing heating systems or water heating systems, which does not sound super appealing at first, but truly impacts our lives in many, many ways. We all live in buildings. That's where we work, where we learn, where we live, where we play. So truly thinking about that and the impact in our lives. But going back to the connection to resilience, so when we are improving those buildings, there is the opportunity to think, well, if I'm changing my heating system, can I elevate it? Because I know I'm going to be in the floodplain. So can we pare those down and think about this holistically at the same time? And hopefully we'll see more of that happening in coming days.
Either of you want to jump in, Brianna, Kari?
Just the, as we're helping rebuild survivor homes in the kingdom, so many homes are on the floodplain and their heating and electrical systems are in their basements. So as we're repairing, you know, we're moving out of the basement because it's just, you know, it's a predictable surprise, right? Like it's gonna flood again and ruin your heating system and your electrical system.
Yeah, and on the same lane, sorry. I mean, in related to buildings, like we're at a point where we have to think about heat and about summers and the fact that we're probably going to need more air conditioning in our buildings. So again, this opportunity that like we're decarbonizing, but also thinking how can we prepare for these events in climate change?
Yeah, I'll just add kind of in the outside of the built world, the natural world, most of the work that I'm seeing and you know, and partnered with people who are doing, it's both mitigation and adaptation at the same time. They're certainly one in the same, for the majority of the like habitat restoration, for example, is exactly both mitigation and adaptation, simultaneously. And you know, and what that means is we're improving the resilience of this habitat for itself to continue to regenerate and be healthy and to be able to produce the goods and services as an ecosystem that it is supposed to, and in turn helps the community surrounding it become more flood resilient or more at least more aware of what the system is naturally supposed to do and look like. So it's. In the natural world, it's most oftentimes mitigation and adaptation are one and the same.
Let's talk about getting involved again. Is there, I'm thinking about low-hanging fruit or something that could be done on a local level that if your city or town has not done it, they should do it. They should think and see if it's been done in their town. I'm thinking about something in a building code, maybe something on a town energy council. What would be something that they should check to see if their town has taken care of this aspect of climate action?
I mean, I can give a few examples of things that we have in Hampton that I think I'm really proud of. So maybe other towns or municipalities, folks in other areas could look to see if they have that. And Hampton is not perfect. We certainly have a lot of work to do, but some of the guiding documents that we have for that work is our master plan. We just updated that. Our Hampton Beach Village District is kind of like a quasi-municipality. They have their own master plan. The Seabrook Hampton Estuary Alliance has an estuary management plan. We are in the process of developing a natural resources inventory for the municipality. The hazard mitigation plan. So all of these documents are guiding documents for how we approach our coastal resilience efforts. And you can certainly check to see if your municipality has these things to see what their priorities are, how they're what they're using for their guidance for moving forward into the future. There's many other options as well, but you know, that's kind of on my mind right now. So I think it's a great way to check to see what's going on in your community.
So thank you for mentioning that. I blanked when that question was asked, but now I'm thinking back in retrospect when the flooding hit, some of the towns in the Northeast Kingdom were impacted much worse than other towns. And in several of those towns, people didn't even know there was like an emergency management plan or a hazard mitigation plan or a flood mitigation plan, which many towns actually have. So nobody knew where to go, where to find it. Like, oh, actually in this town, it was in this person's like filing cabinet and hadn't been updated since 1980, but they found it, you know, months later. So that is a great place to start. Like, look around, ask your town officials, like, what exists? Oh, when was the last time that was updated? Like, is this still valid? Can we improve this? Do we have one at all? Does anybody know where it is? Whose filing cabinet is it in?
I'll add two things to maybe interrogate your city or town about. I think one would be, is there any person in this city whose job description include climate change? And maybe if your town is not small or it doesn't have the resources to have its own sustainability or environment or climate department, has climate been integrated into the departments that exist? So you probably have a parks department or public works, and all of those departments that do classic city services have so much influence on climate action at the city level. So I would encourage people, is like, is anyone thinking about this in my town on their daily responsibilities? And then the other thing I would think about is there any way that community engagement or oversight over climate programs has been integrated or formalized in any way? And I'll give an example of that again from Boston. For Berto, we have something pretty unique that it's called the Berto Review Board. And this is a 9-member volunteer committee that is in charge not of the development or planning of the policy, which is what it's, if community engagement exists, is usually at the planning phase. This is throughout the implementation of Berto. So as long as Berto exists, there will be this review board of volunteers that are residents of Boston that will make very critical implementation decisions. And 6 of those 9 members have to be nominated by community-based organizations and represent the interests of residents of Boston. So in that way, we guarantee that there is some sort of community oversight every year, no matter what happens with city staff, no matter the turnover within the department, there's going to be a community voice there. So thinking about, is there any way that community engagement or oversight has been formalized in the way that climate work is done in your community?
This work is intense, and especially living through the climate impacts at the same time. Sustaining this work, do you have any examples of things that people have done that have made a big difference in morale in terms of climate action?
Well, I think when you're hearing about neighbor-to-neighbor networks and knowing that when something happens to you, your neighbor's going to check in on you, and having that network and that soft tissue and that connectivity to say, I haven't seen you out walking your dog. Are you okay?
I would say something that brings me hope a lot is during my PhD, I had the privilege to interact with a lot of students that are currently doing their undergrad degrees. And myself, when I was an undergrad, we weren't really thinking about justice in the way that the newer generations are talking about it. And I've seen my students really not only come thinking about climate change, but knowing climate change is not impacting people in the same way. What can we do? And climate actions are also not neutral. There's ways in which we're trying to do a good thing for climate change, but actually we're also harming people in different ways. And we know that climate change is a human issue. It's not only this scientific issue or math issue of like, if I put X number of solar panels, then everything's gonna be fine, or if we just do this wind farm, or if we just plant this number of trees. I think there's more and more of an understanding of climate change as an issue of care and humanity as well.
Thank you for listening to Hour 1 of the By Degrees Climate Summit discussion, How Local Communities Are Planning for the Future. Special thanks to our panelists, Kari White, Director of Community Health Equity, Northern Counties Healthcare, Claudia Diaz-Martinez, Policy Fellow for the City of Boston's Environmental Department, and Brianna O'Brien, Conservation Coordinator for the Town of Hampton, New Hampshire. This conversation was recorded at the University of New Hampshire, Durham on May 23, 2024, and is a collaboration between New Hampshire PBS and New Hampshire Public Radio. NHPR's By Degrees reporting project was created in order to tell stories of local people grappling with the challenges of our changing world and exploring possible solutions. If you missed any part of today's program, or if you'd like to support these kinds of community climate conversations, please go to nhpr.org/bydegrees. And whether you're listening in from Maine, the Cape and Islands, Vermont, or streaming this conversation from across the country, please know that your local public radio climate reporters are also worthy of your financial contributions. So support them as generously as you can. And thank you. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our news director is Dan Barrick. This panel discussion was produced by Christina Phillips and Daniela Alley. New Hampshire PBS's production manager is Ben Sparling. NHPR's production manager is me, Dan Cahill. Sound engineer for the By Degrees Climate Summit is Andy Dolph. Today's host was Justine Paradise of the Outside In podcast, which you can listen to at outsideinradio.org. Special thanks to our friends at New Hampshire PBS who made the live stream on these panels possible. And thanks again for listening to the 2024 By Degrees Climate Summit from New Hampshire Public Radio.